Okay, so this is Bio 231, and it's October 14th, and do we have any questions? Yes?
I have a question.
Okay.
Are you going to do the open lab Friday?
Open labs, I'm still working on that, so please check your emails. Okay, so it would have to be later in the afternoon.
It would?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
On Friday?
Yeah, on Friday.
What time would
right.
you do it later?
I have no clue at this moment. Absolutely no clue when it will be. Yeah, because the practicums are starting today. So they're going to wrap around until Tuesday of next week, right? All right. You know, I did put some videos on Blackboard for you, and some people are having trouble playing the videos. They can see the video sometimes, but not get the audio track. Some people get the audio track, but not the video. And it kind of depends on the plugin that you're using and when was the last time you updated that particular plugin. Like, for instance, Windows Media Player is a plugin that I'm talking about. And it works fine on various computers that I use. So you might try a couple of different things. Number one, update the Windows Media Player. And I think they have Windows Media Player 11 right now. So if you're using version 5 or 4 or 3, something like that, then there might be some problems with it, right? So update the media player that you have, or maybe even better yet, use this plugin, the DVX plugin. It's a free plugin, and it's really, really nice. It can play HD videos, and I think it can play up to 25 videos at one time. So it's some super programming. It's a very small program, but it's very powerful, and I've never heard of anybody having problems running any kind of video in any kind of format, AVI files or WMV files. So try that, and you can get the videos. All right, so any other, yes, question? You could not see it? Could you hear it but not see it, or see it but not hear? Oh, that's too bad. Okay, maybe in the Windows Media Player, you can click on Tools and then say Update, and then it might run just fine. Yeah, sorry about that. Yeah, so I can't update all those computers on campus. That's the best way to try that. And that's a problem because sometimes when you're using a computer on campus, you don't have administrator privileges to download a plugin, but you might want to try that anyway on the computers in the library. And then copy the video to the hard drive and then just drag it and drop it into the DVX player and you can watch that. All right, so we were talking about the introductory chapter to the nervous system last time. Well, we just started, right? So I said, make sure you understand the organization of the nervous system. All right, and hopefully you all have done your pre-lecture reading assignment as well, and the key will pop up tonight so you can check yourself. All right, so let's look at some organization of the nervous system. First, the structural organization. You can break the nervous system down into two main categories, two main components, and those would be the central nervous system, and the second component would be the peripheral nervous system. The central nervous system we see in, what color is this?
Yellow.
Okay, we see that in yellow. And the peripheral nervous system is, you see, is labeled in red. How'd I do? Really good. Okay, fantastic. All right, so furthermore, the central nervous system, you should be able to break down into its main components, which would be the brain and the spinal cord. And the line of demarcation between the brain and spinal cord is that big hole in the occipital bone. Who can remember what that is? That's from the previous practicum. The foramen magnum, right? So anything superior to the foramen magnum is considered the brain. Everything below is considered the spinal cord. Right? And if we put brain and spinal cord together, those are the building blocks of the central nervous system. And peripheral nervous system is everything else outside the brain and spinal cord. So that includes nerves as well as some ganglia, and we'll define what a ganglion is in just a little bit. All right, we can also think about the nervous system, its components in a functional way, and not just in structure, but we always want to understand function as well. There are some parts of it that bring information from the periphery, like from sensors, for instance, like photoreceptors in our eyes or touch receptors in our skin or temperature receptors in our skin. And then these send electrical signals to the central nervous system. So we call these the sensory neurons. And they have another name. They are called afferent. You might not want to pronounce it afferent, but I do in class so that you can hear what I'm speaking very clearly. Usually we just say afferent, right? But afferent is how you spell it. So the afferent nerves bring information into the central nervous system, and the central nervous system then decides what to do with that information. For instance, if you're asleep, what does it do with that information? Mostly it ignores it, right? It doesn't wake you up. Unless it's maybe some threatening information, then certain parts of your central nervous system might actually wake you up, right? So it integrates information, makes a decision what to do with that information, and then it sends decisions back out to your body through motor output neurons. And another name for motor output are efferent neurons, right? So you got afferent and efferent, and you should know which way the signals are going. So if I say afferent neurons, which way are signals going? And use central nervous system and peripheral nervous system in your idea. Afferent is which way? From the peripheral nervous system into the central nervous system. And if it's an efferent signal, it's going to start in the central nervous system and move into the peripheral nervous system. Okay, so these are the functional neurons in our nervous system. Okay. All right, so let's look at tissue of the nervous system. So let's just review really quick. How many major kinds of tissues do you have in your body? You have? Yeah, you've got four, right? You got epithelium, connective tissue, muscle tissue, which we're just kind of getting over right now. And then this is the fourth tissue, which is nervous tissue, right? And from the beginning of class, you should remember that there are two kinds of cells that make up nervous tissue. All right, there are neurons which conduct electrical information, and then there are support cells that don't conduct electrical information. And so we're going to learn some by their structure and some by their function in this particular chapter. So first, let's talk about neurons. All right, so neurons have a couple pieces to them. They have a cell body which contains the nucleus and rough endoplasmic reticulum for making proteins and Golgi apparatus for modifying those proteins. All right, neurons are non-dividing cells. They live for a really long time. They have a really high metabolic rate. And and because of that, nerve cells don't regenerate very much if they become damaged. All right, so let's take a look at a typical kind of neuron. So these are the three parts of a neuron I want you to be aware of: the cell body, the axon, and dendrites. So a typical neuron looks something like this. All right, so here is a nice exam figure for you. All right, you don't have to label the micrograph, but you have to be able to label the illustration and understand what's happening with the illustration. So we see a neuron right here, and it's kind of a strange looking cell because it has all of these projections, and these projections we just call processes. You can see some of the processes are relatively short and highly branched, which we see right here, and these are what we call dendrites. The dendrites are the receiving part of a neuron. They receive signals from other neurons. And then this major part of the cell right here, this is what we call the cell body. And it also has another name. Sometimes we call that the soma, because soma really means body. So the cell body, and it contains the nucleus, and it has all of the cytoplasmic organelles. Okay, and then the second kind of projection that a neuron has is what we call an axon. And it's a very long projection. It can be a foot long or 2 feet long, maybe 3 feet long. All right, so it's very, very, very long, but you still can't see it because it's still microscopic in diameter. All right, but it's not like any other kind of cell that we've looked at so far because it's very, very long. And the axon is the sending part of a neuron. And neurons send information as an electrical signal. So electrical signals develop on a dendrite, it's passed to the cell body, and from the cell body it's passed to the axon, and then it zips down the axon to the axon terminals right here. So that information, as it's moving, we call that an electrical impulse. And can an electrical impulse move in two directions, or does it only move in one direction? All right, and you see that on this slide right here. So a neuron really is a one-way street. Information only passes from a dendrite to cell body and down an axon and not backwards, right? And what you have to take a physiology class to really appreciate why that is, but it's good for you to at least know that's true in this class. Okay. So this part right here, which kind of looks like a funnel, and it actually kind of functions as a funnel, right? We call this the axon hillock, because this is funneling signals down into the axon so that it can be transmitted all the way down to the axon terminals. All right, these axon terminals release a signaling chemical, which we call a neurotransmitter. We're going to take a look at these little axon terminals, and maybe from this slide can you see that they have a little bulge on them? They're loaded with mitochondria and vesicles that contain that signaling molecule, which we call a neurotransmitter. We call it a neurotransmitter because this cell is a neuron, and it's going to use that chemical to transmit information from one cell to another. So we just call that a neurotransmitter. All right, the other kind of cell that we see on this slide right here is white in color, right? And so these are the support cells, in particular within the peripheral nervous system. These are called Schwann cells, and you can see the extent of a Schwann cell right here, and a Schwann cell wraps itself around an axon, and basically it acts like insulation on a wire. So this insulates the electrical signal so that it doesn't leak out of the axon, but we're also going to discuss some other functions of this particular Schwann cell. So on this slide we see a neuron colored in yellow, right? Is that yellow? Yeah, very good. And then the support cell, or the Schwann cell right here, that is colored in white. Okay, we see that the Schwann cells don't make a continuous sheath around the axon, but there are breaks, right? And those breaks we call nodes of Ranvier. So here's a node right here, here's another one right here, and here's another one right here. Okay, so I think that's all we want to know about this particular diagram. Right, but there are other shapes. Well, I tell you what, this neuron right here is what we call a multipolar neuron because it has many, many dendrites on one end, right, and it has this one long axon on the other end of the neuron. There are other kinds of neurons depending on their shape, and I do want you to know what the other shapes are called. All right, so here's the one we were just talking about, and it doesn't have any Schwann cells on it. This kind of neuron we find bringing information away from the central nervous system to the periphery, especially skeletal muscle. So this would be an efferent neuron, and another name for an efferent neuron is a motor neuron right here. So a good example of a multipolar neuron by function would be an efferent neuron. Here's another one. Has a little bit different shape, right? We see that it has two very long projections, and this is what we call a bipolar neuron, right? And the dendrites we see over here, and this is the axon. These are the axon terminals, because can you see the little swellings right here? This is the part of the neuron that is going to be releasing neurotransmitter. So signals can only go from dendrites to cell body down this axon. We don't have a lot of bipolar neurons, but where we find them are in special sensory organs, like in our nose, in our eye, right? And so there aren't very many places. But, of course, vision and the sense of smell are very important, so these still are very important neurons, even though we don't have a lot of them. The third kind of neuron we call unipolar, or sometimes pseudo-unipolar. Right? We have a central short process that's coming off the cell body. Oh, what's another name for the cell body right here? A soma, right? So here we have a single short process coming off the soma, and then it bifurcates into two very long processes. Right? This one right here, these contain receptive endings. So in terms of this multipolar neuron that we used as a model, what part of the neuron is the receptive part? What did we call this right here? These were the dendrites, right? So you could consider these dendrites right here because this is the receptive part of the cell and it's going to send electrical impulses toward the cell body. This one right here we find in the periphery of our body. So hence we call this the peripheral process of this particular neuron. And this is the central process because this is the part of the neuron that actually enters the central nervous system. So we see a signal starting on these receptive endings and ending up in the central nervous system. So how would we classify the function of this neuron?
Afferent.
It is afferent, yeah, or sensory. If you want to say afferent, that's fine. But in lecture, I'll just say afferent. This is an afferent as well because it's involved with sensing. It's used in the visual system, auditory system, okay, and olfactory system for olfaction, sense of smell. All right, so this unipolar neuron is very important because this is how all sensory neurons are formed. All right, so here we have an example. We have sensory endings of this particular neuron maybe in your skin. Right, and then this travels all the way to the spinal cord, and as it's entering, right before it enters the spinal cord, there's a little bump right here where there's going to be a grouping of nerve cell bodies of thousands or tens of thousands of sensory neurons. Right, so there's a bulge in this particular entry point to the spinal cord, and then here is the central process that actually enters the spinal cord. And of course, the spinal cord is what part of your nervous system? It's part of your central nervous system, right? So here we see the peripheral process because it's in the periphery, and here's the central process because it ends up in the spinal cord. Okay. All right, so if we have, so the central nervous system starts right about here. Here we have a group of nerve cell bodies. And a group of nerve cell bodies in the peripheral nervous system has got a special name that I want you to know, and that's called a ganglion. All right, so if there is a group of nerve cell bodies any place, we call that a ganglion. So maybe go back to that very first word slide that I had for you, all right, which is right up over here. So we got central nervous system and peripheral nervous system. So under peripheral nervous system, write in that term, ganglion. All right, so peripheral nervous system have ganglia all over the place. And it's a functional center that is containing or housing nerve cell bodies or the soma of thousands of neurons someplace. Okay. So that's important for you to know. So those are the three main kinds of neurons that I want you to know. Multipolar, that's very important because they function as motor neurons. Right? Bipolar, these are important for special senses. And unipolar, these are sensory or afferent neurons. All right, let me go back to that one of the first slides that I showed you. Okay, in terms of functional characteristics, where was that at? Right here. All right, so we could label this diagram with a particular shape of neuron. All right, so sensory or afferent neuron, what kind of shape of a neuron would you put here? Okay, this would be a good example of a pseudo-unipolar or maybe bipolar. And since it's the eye, there's definitely going to be some bipolar cells in there, but not multipolar. All right. And then once the signal enters the central nervous system, there are neurons that are completely found only within the central nervous system. They're used for sharing information and integrating information. These would be the multipolar neurons. All right. And then once the integration center makes up its mind what to do, it sends that decision out via efferent or motor neurons, and this cell shape is also a multipolar neuron. Okay, so I do want you to be able to recognize those cell shapes and tell me what the function is as well of them. All right, we'll do a little flash quiz maybe at the end of class today or next time to help you see those different shapes. Okay, and so the cells, the neurons that lie completely within the central nervous system, right, they interface between an afferent and efferent pathway, or between a motor and sensory pathway, or motor and sensory neurons. We sometimes call them association neurons, or sometimes we call those interneurons. Those are neurons in between afferent and efferent neurons. All right, so that's the important thing about neurons, but don't forget, neurons conduct electrical information. That's what they're specialized to do, very quickly over long distances. That's their job. All right, the second kind of nervous system cell doesn't conduct electrical impulses. They're support cells. They have a number of different functions, and so I want you to be able to recognize them by shape, and then once you recognize them by shape, you should be able to tell me what their function is as well. All right, so these sometimes are called support cells or neuroglial cells, or sometimes just neuroglia. All right, so go ahead, say neuroglia. Neuroglia, yeah, okay, it kind of has to roll off your tongue just right. Okay, and we find neuroglia, different kinds of neuroglia in different parts of the nervous system. There are some that are found only in the central nervous system, and then there are a couple found only in the, what's the opposite to central nervous system? Peripheral nervous system. So I do want you to know where we find these cells. So we got four main kinds in the central nervous system, and those are astrocytes, microglia, ependymal, and oligodendrocytes. So let's take a look at what these look like, and then I'll tell you what their function is. So here is a really nice picture of these different kinds of support cells. This first one right here is an astrocyte, right? And it's kind of beige colored. And you can see a neuron right here, which is still yellow colored. And this astrocyte has a number of projections coming off of it. It almost looks like it has dendrites, but remember, support cells don't conduct electrical information. So what does this cell do? Well, this cell, you can see, it has a process connected to a capillary or blood vessel, and there's oxygen and there's nutrients in this part in blood, right? And these are the compounds that this neuron needs to survive. And don't forget, neurons are highly metabolic. They need a lot of oxygen. They need a lot of glucose to stay functioning so that you can maintain consciousness, for instance. So these astrocytes act as a special delivery system, absorbing nutrients from the blood and then delivering it directly to this neuron right here. So it's a special delivery system. It's a nice bridge that carries nutrients in, and it can also help get rid of toxic waste chemicals from this particular neuron. So that's one important function. Acts like a bridge for nutrients. All right, well, there are many compounds in the blood that would be harmful to this neuron because they are so active. Any interruption of the activities of this cell, right, and you lose consciousness. And that could be fatal, right? You could be walking down a flight of stairs, and if you faint, what would happen? Well, your head would just bounce down the stairs, right? So all the things that are in your blood, okay, should not have access to these neurons right here because it could produce a coma. So there's a special barrier, at least in the brain. We call it the blood-brain barrier, and it keeps out harmful chemicals from getting to these neurons right here. So astrocytes also help form that blood-brain barrier, right, which is really important. And you know what? If there's a pharmaceutical company that's developing a drug specifically to affect your brain in a certain way, the scientists have to figure out a way to get around this blood-brain barrier. It's part of the design process, right? Because most drugs are prevented from entering the brain, even though they're in your circulatory system. All right, so let's see. What were some of the other functions of astrocytes? Involved in the blood-brain barrier, glucose transport. Also, well, we didn't talk much about the function of neurons yet, but neurons release a neurotransmitter. That's how they pass information from cell to cell through a synapse. And astrocytes help get rid of that neurotransmitter through what we call reuptake. It takes it away from stimulating a neighboring cell so that the mode of communication is very fast. right? So that it's not long-lasting, which is very important. All right, and then there's something else, and this is what's really amazing. All right, one of the first things we said about the nervous system is that it doesn't regenerate itself very well, and that the cells live for a very long time, and when they die, they're not really replaced. But we're learning more and more about that all the time. We now know that astrocytes can release a chemical that can stimulate nerve cell regeneration. But not only that, but it can help form new connections between nerve cells. So it works on enhancing the network that's inside our brain. And the more we use our brains, the more sophisticated it becomes because it makes new connections between nerve cells. Right, and that chemical that's released by nerve cells in a lot of circumstances is called brain-derived neurotrophic factor, BDNF. And that causes our brains to grow. So we talked about muscle, and this is kind of a nice example. If you walk around all day with a 5-pound weight and you curl that 5-pound weight, what happens to your biceps and brachialis? What happens to it? Does it say, oh, forget it, and then it just dies and goes away, or what happens to it? Yeah, it responds to that stress, right? Those muscles get bigger and stronger, as long as you don't rip them up during that exercise, as long as the exercise is appropriate, all right? And what happens if you stress a bone? What happens to those bones that the biceps are attached to? They get bigger and stronger, too, and that's how you protect yourself from osteoporosis, right? All right, and guess what happens to your brain when you exercise it, when you study, when you learn new things? Guess what happens to your brain? It grows as well. It doesn't get a lot bigger. Your head doesn't get any bigger, but the connections become more intricate, and there's more nerve fibers in there. All right? So that is really important. So your brain, right now, when you're taking a hard class, like a physiology class or anatomy class, guess what's happening to your brain? Too bad you can't hear it in there, but it's remodeling itself. It's growing. It's making new connections. So the brain that you have after taking a class like this is really not anything like the brain you had before you take a class like this. It's actually kind of scary to think of that. Okay? All right, so that's the importance of those astrocytes, right? They actually help remodel your brain to make it more efficient. Then you can learn things a whole lot easier, right, as long as you apply it. And, of course, you have to apply it properly, just like exercising a muscle, right? You can't over-exercise it because then that wouldn't be helpful. Okay, let's look at another kind of cell, the microglia cell. Okay, microglia have a bunch of processes on them as well, but they're smaller, so it's a thinner kind of cell, and it doesn't form a bridge between a neuron and a capillary. These cells right here wander around in your central nervous system, your brain, right, because we're talking about central nervous system, microglia cells. And these act a lot like white blood cells that are in your blood. So does anybody, we haven't talked about white blood cells, but does anybody have an idea what does a white blood cell do in your circulatory system? Yes, it's part of your immune system. It fights infections. And so that's the job of this microglia cell too. It's wandering around all of these neurons looking for things that don't belong there. Could be bacteria, fungi, viruses, whatever, and when it bumps into something like that, what's its job? To kill it, right, okay, because it doesn't belong. And as a matter of fact, these microglia cells are even looking for tumor cells. And if a tumor cell hasn't figured out how to make itself invisible, this microglia cell will also kill that tumor cell. And so that really explains why there's spontaneous remission in some people that have brain tumors, right? They can heal themselves if all of a sudden these microglia cells learn to recognize that tumor, and then they're cured of that particular kind of cancer. So that would be really nice to figure out exactly how these microglia cells work, because that would be a perfect way to fight all cancers if we could figure out how to teach microglia to heal, right, or kill those tumors inside somebody's brain. Okay, so those are really important cells. All right, so for years and years and years, people were only interested in neurons within the central nervous system because they transmitted information, and they would ignore the support cells. So now tell me what your impression is of these support cells. Pretty cool and amazing, right? So now people are very interested in knowing what all the functions that these microglia cells are performing, and that potential for fighting disease processes, right, is immense. All right, here are some more. The ependymal cells. There are holes within the brain. There are cavities in the brain, which we call ventricles. So a ventricle is a hole in an organ. And the ventricles, in the next chapter, we'll see what all their functions are, but it helps support the brain, and it can nourish different parts of it, can take away waste products, and it helps adjust the pH of the brain. And these ependymal cells right here line all of the cavities inside the brain. So these are sort of analogous to that membrane that we saw on the inside of a bone. What did we call that? The endosteum, right? So cavities have a lining. The brain cavities have a lining. And then where did we see another kind of cavity? We saw cavities, the synovial cavity, right? There's a membrane, synovial membrane. It secretes fluid into a joint capsule. Well, these cells right here are specialized in certain parts of the brain to secrete a fluid into those cavities, right? And we call that cerebral spinal fluid because those cavities are in the brain as well as the spinal cord. So that's the job of these ependymal cells. And they also act as a barrier, preventing bacteria that might be in the ventricles or viruses that get into the ventricles, right, prevent them from getting and infecting the neurons of the brain. So they're important as well for that particular reason. All right, so those are a couple. It isolates the cerebral spinal fluid from the brain in case there's harmful things in the cerebral spinal fluid, but it also produces that cerebral spinal fluid. All right, the last cell we see right here is an, go ahead, say it, oligodendrocyte. And an oligodendrocyte, here we see the cell body, and there's a number of processes coming off. And when it reaches an axon, it wraps itself around an axon. So this is similar to that cell that I talked about previously, which we call a Schwann cell. It's wrapping insulation around this axon, right? And the chemical name for that insulation is called myelin, right? So that's important for you to know. You always have to know a bunch of chemical names in here. Like, what's the name of that chemical that's a natural sunscreen in our body? It's made in our integument. Keratin is close, but melanin is what I'm thinking of. Keratin is the chemical that's inside the cells of your skin that gives skin its strength. All right. What's another chemical that gives your connective tissue strength and bone strength from twisting and tension? Sounds like keratin, but it's collagen. Yeah, so it's always a good idea to remember all the names of different chemicals in your body. And this particular one that forms these layers of insulation is myelin. So these different layers of insulation, we call that the myelin sheath. All right, so that's why we name this. All right, so an oligodendrocyte we see in the central nervous system is different from a Schwann cell because it can lay down a myelin sheath around numerous axons, not just one, because of all these different processes. All right, so if you see this kind of arrangement of something making a myelin sheath, you're going to say, what part of the nervous system? What are the two main parts? Central and peripheral. And here you're going to say central nervous system. Okay. All right. And these guys also play a very important role in preventing regeneration of nerve tissue in the spinal cord and in the brain. All right. So if we want to really find out about how to help somebody's spinal cord regenerate, which you know is basically an impossibility today, we probably have to know a lot about these cells right here to kind of tune down their activity to allow the nervous tissue to regenerate. All right, so these are the glial cells of the central nervous system. And here we see the neuroglia cells of the peripheral nervous system, which is what? Everything else outside central nervous system. We see the cells that wrap a myelin sheath around the axons. These are what we call Schwann cells. That's one kind. And what are these little nodes between the Schwann cells called? Nodes of Ranvier, right? And so that's one kind of cell. And the other cells we see completely surrounding the nerve cell body of this neuron right here. Can anybody remember what kind of neuron is this by its shape? Is that a, what are they, multipolar, unipolar, or bipolar? This is a unipolar because I just see one simple process coming off here. So this is a unipolar. Sometimes you call that a pseudo-unipolar. So this would be an example of a sensory neuron. What's another name for sensory? Afferent, right? So this is the peripheral process, and I recognize these as dendrites. How could I recognize these as being the dendritic process and not the axonal process? Because I don't see any little swelling at the tip of this process right here. Okay? If it was an axon terminus, I would see a swelling, which is going to form a synapse with a neighboring cell. Okay. Well, let me tell you now about the function of oligodendrocytes and Schwann cells. Right? They wrap myelin around an axon that kind of insulates the axon. But the real reason why it's there is because if we have a regular neuron, let me go find it. Okay, if we have a regular neuron without myelin, like let's look at this. Well, I tell you what, let's just look at this unipolar neuron right here, which is similar to the one that we were just looking at. This one doesn't have a myelin sheath. So when a signal, right, a nerve impulse moves along this axon right here, it has to move molecule by molecule by molecule by molecule. And how small are molecules? Really, really small. So how many molecules are there in the whole length of this axon? Well, there's billions, right? So it's got to go by billions of steps down the axon. And so that just means that when a nerve impulse moves down an unmyelinated axon, it's really slow. We call that continuous conduction. If it's a non-myelinated nerve fiber, it moves by continuous conduction, and it's really slow because it has to happen molecule by molecule. But if it is a myelinated axon, like what we see right here, right, that nerve impulse goes from one node of Ranvier and then skips over what? Trillions of molecules to the next node, and then to the next node, to the next node, so that nerve impulse actually skips or hops down the axon, and guess what happens to speed of conduction? It speeds up. It could be 10 or 100 times faster. All right, so if you step out in traffic, and it looks like a big semi-tractor, trailer, truck is going to run you over, would you like to have fast axons or fast neurons or ones that are slow in transmitting information? Yeah, fast. So there's a huge advantage in having axons that are myelinated. Here's the sign-in sheet. Make sure you sign the sign-in sheet. Yeah, we still have plenty of time. So that's the beauty of a myelin sheath. They're very, very fast. And the term we use for that kind of conduction when a nerve impulse skips from one node to another, we call that saltatory conduction versus continuous. So that could be a question on the test. What kind of conduction is fast? You would say saltatory. Which kind is slow? Continuous.
That has like S-A-L-T.
Saltatory, yeah. Oh, do I have it misspelled in the slide? Saltatory? No. Oh, maybe spell checker changed something on me. Where is it? Saltatory. No, that's wrong. S-A-L-T. A, oops. There's no U in there. Let me take that. Saltatory. Saltatory. Okay. Conduction. Saltatory. That means fast because it's myelinated. And clinically, that's really important because every once in a while, somebody's own immune system will start to attack oligodendrocytes. And where does that happen? So when somebody's immune system attacks oligodendrocytes in their body, what part of their body is under attack? The brain. Right? So then those oligodendrocytes become destroyed. The speed of nerve conduction is all disrupted. The brain can't communicate with itself very well, so it produces a lot of motor deficits and cognitive deficits. And that's the underlying principle with multiple sclerosis. All right, so that's why sometimes people with multiple sclerosis are given drugs to decrease the activity of their immune system, right? And so that protects the oligodendrocytes in their brain. So all of these things are very important clinically. Okay, so this is going to now take us to how neurons communicate with each other, which is just kind of a subset of how a lot of cells communicate with each other. And we actually looked at something that's very familiar with or similar to how neurons communicate with each other, and that is the neuromuscular junction. And a neuromuscular junction is just a specific kind of synapse. So I do want you to know something about a synapse. So I could ask you, what's the structural and functional unit of life? What would you say? The cell. Yeah, really good. What's the structural and functional unit of contraction? Muscle? Well, it's in a muscle. Sarcomere. Yeah, really, really good. What's the structural and functional unit of compact bone? Osteon. Okay. All right, so here is another one of these things. The structural and functional unit of communication between cells is a synapse. And I don't have this on my slides, but I think it's pretty important. Maybe I've mentioned this previously when we talked about the neuromuscular junction. All right. Synapse. All right, there are two kinds. I don't know, do I have two kinds on there? Let me see. The first kind is what we call a chemical synapse. And the second general kind is what we call an electrical synapse. I don't know if I have this in my notes. Okay. Okay, it was in another chapter I talked about it. Okay. Well, the major kind of synapse we find all over the body is a chemical synapse. So information is transmitted between cells as what kind of signal? A chemical signal. Right? If it's an electrical synapse, information passes from one cell to a neighboring cell as an electrical signal. All right, so what we're going to be interested in this particular chapter is a chemical synapse. So there has to be a chemical signal that's released from one neuron that's going to excite another neuron. And that happens through a synapse. All right, so I could ask you, what is the structural and functional unit of communication between neurons called? Synapse. Right, and then we're going to learn something about a synapse. And if you know how a synapse works, you know pretty much how all synapses work. Right, just like if you know something about a cell, you know basically almost everything about life. Okay, so a synapse is made up of these following three regions. We've got the little swelling at the end of a nerve axon, and it has a number of different names. Sometimes it's called a synaptic knob. Sometimes it's called just the axon terminus. Sometimes it's called a terminal button because it's a little bit of a swelling. Sometimes it's called a bouton terminale, or sometimes it's called a terminal bouton, right? So it has a number of different names, and a lot of different languages kind of contribute to all those different terms, right? And the synaptic knob is a bulge at the end of the axon, and in particular, the presynaptic neuron. So this is the neuron that is going to be sending information that happens before the synapse, so we call that the presynaptic neuron. Guess what we call the neuron that receives the information? It occurs after the synapse, so we call that the postsynaptic neuron. That's how we think of these two different kinds of neurons. All right, so in that bouton terminale, it's loaded with mitochondria and endoplasmic reticulum and also vesicles that are filled with that little signaling molecule that's going to be released, and we call that a neurotransmitter. And one common name of a neurotransmitter is acetylcholine, or we just abbreviate it ACH. And I think we ran into ACH already at the neuromuscular junction. That's the one that excites skeletal muscle cells. All right, the second part of a synapse is the synaptic cleft. That's the actual space between the two cells that will communicate with each other. And then we have the postsynaptic membrane. on the cell that's going to receive these signals. Right? The postsynaptic membrane has a number of receptors that can bind that neurotransmitter, and when it binds the neurotransmitter, it's going to start another electrical signal up on the postsynaptic cell. So let's see what that arrangement looks like. So we have all right, so here we have two cells that are going to communicate with each other. And does this look like a two-way street or a one-way street? It's a one-way street, so just like signals can only go from dendrites to cell body down an axon, signals can only go in one direction across the synapse. And that's from the presynaptic neuron into the postsynaptic neuron. And there are spaces right here between the axon terminals and the receptive part or the dendrites of the postsynaptic neuron. So it's illustrated very nicely with this illustration down here. And now you can see the actual space between these nerve cells. All right, so this is not an electrical synapse. This is a chemical synapse. Because if it was electrical, guess what would have to happen across this space right here? If electricity was going to hop across this space. You've seen electricity hop across from one object to another. All right, like static electricity. If you have static electricity and you reach out and touch somebody, right, and you get a little jolt, you see what? Like a little spark. And you've all seen lightning before. Okay, that's what we call arcing. So if this synapse was an electrical synapse, there would actually have to be little lightning bolts between these cells. And guess what? We have no lightning bolts in our body like that. All right, so the only way for these cells to communicate is when the presynaptic cell releases a chemical and the chemical moves across the synaptic cleft and then excites the postsynaptic cell, and it excites it in such a way that it creates another electrical signal in the postsynaptic cell. So the mode of transmission that I want you to appreciate in a chemical synapse is that information is transmitted through the presynaptic neuron as what kind of signal? Electrical or chemical? Okay, you know what? It's going to be as an electrical signal. Okay. Electrical signal down a neuron, that's what they're specialized to do, to transmit electrical information very rapidly. And then what happens to that information? It gets converted into a chemical signal within the synapse, right? And then that same information, of course, gets started up down the postsynaptic neuron is what kind of signal? As an electrical signal. So for a chemical synapse, what I want you to appreciate, right, is that it goes from an electrical signal to a chemical signal, and it gets converted back into an electrical signal. So it goes electrical, chemical, electrical. And we'll see why that's really cool and important in a little bit. Okay? Until it gets to the synapse, and then the information gets converted into a chemical. All right, and then that information gets reconverted back into an electrical signal on the postsynaptic neuron. Okay, so that's pretty much the definition of a chemical synapse. So it goes electrical, chemical, electrical. Okay, that electrical signal begins at a dendrite because dendrites receive information. That's the receiving part of a neuron. All right, so we're not going to talk a lot about how these different electrical and chemical signals develop and the metabolism and all that kind of stuff, but in physiology, we're really interested in all that kind of stuff.
So basically, just like as a dendrite, it's an electrical signal. When it gets to the synapse, it becomes chemical.
That's right, and we're going to talk about how it becomes a chemical signal in just a little bit. Maybe right now. And then when the signaling molecule moves across the synapse, it generates another electrical signal on the dendrites of the postsynaptic cell, and that electrical signal then does what? Oh, it zips down the next neuron, the postsynaptic neuron. Okay. So we're going to look and see how that happens. Okay. All right, so I'm just going to show you a slide while talking about all this information on this slide right here. All right, so here is a nice picture that's in your book. So we're really zooming in, right? So here's the presynaptic neuron. Here's the postsynaptic neuron. And what's that structure, how neurons communicate with each other between them? That's the synapse right here, right? So we want to look at the structure of the synapse. So let's zoom into this region. And we see that the axon terminus is what? Swollen. It's large. It's enlarged. So we call this what? A terminal button or bouton terminale or a synaptic knob, right? Or various kinds of terms to it. And here you can see some more on the postsynaptic neuron. So an electrical signal, right, in motion is what we call a nerve impulse. So a nerve impulse flows down the axon over the synaptic knob right here. And when it does, calcium is going to enter, right? Calcium ions are going to enter from outside the cell into the synaptic knob. And that calcium is going to be a signal for fusing these synaptic vesicles that contain neurotransmitter to the presynaptic membrane. So it's going to cause the docking of these vesicles and the release, the secretion, or you could think of the exocytosis of neurotransmitter into the synaptic cleft right here. So that's the space between the neurons. And then that neurotransmitter is going to diffuse everywhere around in this synaptic cleft. It's going to bump into the postsynaptic membrane right here, where there's going to be receptors. And when the neurotransmitter binds those receptors, it opens up certain channels that allow other electrical compounds, which we call ions, to enter the cell, like a sodium ion, and that's going to start up an electrical signal in the postsynaptic cell. Okay, so I just want to go over that one more time. An electrical signal comes down. It causes the entry of calcium into the synaptic knob. That causes these vesicles to release neurotransmitter. Neurotransmitter diffuses across the synaptic cleft. And when it binds to the postsynaptic membrane right here, that starts a second electrical signal in the postsynaptic cell. And then it does what? It zips down this axon. All right, so you have an electrical signal. It gets converted into a chemical signal in the synapse. And then that chemical signal is converted into an electrical signal on the postsynaptic cell. So that this is the function of a synapse. So here's a little animation that shows that. Maybe, and it's got an audio track, right? I don't think we're going to listen to the audio track. But here we see an action potential. This is a nerve impulse coming down. It bumps into this channel that's normally closed. Oops, let me pause it. It's normally closed, but when the electrical signal flows over this protein, it opens up and it allows calcium. CA stands for calcium. Calcium enters the synaptic knob, and what do these guys look like? These are what we call synaptic vesicles, and inside the synaptic vesicles we have the neurotransmitter. Who's got a specific name of a neurotransmitter? Like acetylcholine. Yeah, acetylcholine is a perfect name. All right, so let's start the video up again. As calcium enters this cell right here, guess what's going to happen to these synaptic vesicles? They're going to start moving around. They fuse to the presynaptic membrane, and the neurotransmitter is released, and that neurotransmitter diffuses around in this whole space. What is this space right here called? That's the synaptic cleft. And then here is the membrane of the postsynaptic cell, and I can see another protein in that membrane right here. And here's a little gate, but we see the what? The gates are closed. So it's not acting as a channel, but when the neurotransmitter binds to this protein, watch what happens to these gates right here. All right, hopefully they're going to bind. So there's acetylcholine. Blah, blah, they're just going to drift around by diffusion. When they bump into these sites right here, look what happens to that gate. It opens up. And when it opens up, it allows, it allows sodium to enter the cell. And sodiums are ions. That establishes the electrical signal in the postsynaptic cell right here. So This link will be in Blackboard so that you can watch it and listen to the discussion of how this synapse works. All right, so that's basically how all synapses work, including the neuromuscular junction. Okay, so let's look at some questions right here. Can information ever be passed from the postsynaptic neuron back into the presynaptic neuron through a synapse? Well, it's always just a one-way street. And I'll go back to that video and we'll see why that is in a second. All right? Another question. How is information transmitted within a neuron? As what kind of signal? Electrical or chemical? Electrical within a neuron. And how is information transmitted between neurons? As a chemical signal, as a neurotransmitter. And in the example that we looked at, okay, that specific example was acetylcholine. So why is it that signals can't go backwards? All right, so that's because one of these cells has neurotransmitter. Which cell has a neurotransmitter that can be released? Only the presynaptic neuron. Right, so that's going to be the signaling molecule that moves across the synapse. The postsynaptic cell right here doesn't have any neurotransmitter to release, to talk to the presynaptic cell. That's one reason. Right? The second reason is this receptor right here. What cell has this receptor? Only the postsynaptic cell. So only the postsynaptic cell can recognize neurotransmitter. The presynaptic cell doesn't have a receptor. So it's completely blind to whether there's neurotransmitter in the synaptic cleft or not. So signals can only go from the presynaptic cell into the postsynaptic cell as a result of that, or it's just a one-way street for that information. All right, so that synapse is a really important figure. I'm sure that's an exam figure. Okay. So, okay, I'm not going to talk about different kinds of transmission of electrical signals, all right, but I do want to tell you something about this section right here. And it has to do with what we call the resting membrane potential. All cells in your body, if they're alive, act like a battery. So this is really strange, I think, to think about, because do you think your biology and cell phones are what? Inherently a lot different, or calculators are a lot different than biology, but cells use electrical information like we just saw, or electrical events to transmit information like we just saw, but all cells act like a battery. So what can you tell me about a battery? What do you know about a battery? Okay, it stores energy. Yeah, it stores energy. Okay. It has two sides to it. We call them terminals, right? So pretty much all batteries have two terminals. Even a big battery in your car has got two terminals. One is what we call a plus terminal, and the other is what we call a negative terminal. And there's just a separation in charge. So on one terminal, we have a lot of positive charges, and then on the other terminal, we have a lot of negative charges. And electrical charges, if we allow them to move around, guess what electrical charges like to do? Do they repel each other or do they attract each other? They attract each other. So opposite charges attract. Right? So what a battery does, it separates the charge out, but if we allow the positive and negative charges to interact with each other, like putting a wire over the two terminals, what happens? Well, they rush together, right? And release a lot of energy and heat up the wire, right? That's how we run these lights right here, because these electrical charges are trying to cancel each other out, okay? Well, cells do the same thing. They act like a battery. They're going to separate charge from across the cell membrane. So what do we have right here? Here is a picture of a cell at rest. And not just a neuron, but any kind of cell in your body is more positive on the outside, and on the inside it is more negative. Right, so all cells do this. And if a cell can't separate charge out like this, if the charge is the same across the cell membrane, what can you tell me about that cell? Say if you have a battery and the electrical charge is the same on both terminals, what can you tell me about that battery? It's dead. The same thing with this cell. If there's no separation and charge across the membrane, that cell is dead. So it's really important that cells maintain this separation and charge. And guess what kind of energy molecule is needed to do that? What's your favorite energy molecule? ATP. That's right. So ATP is necessary to maintain this separation and charge. All right, so this is what we look at in terms of a cell at rest. Okay. When a cell is stimulated, right, we have positive charges from the outside want to rush to the inside of the cell. And then what happens to the membrane? The voltage disappears a little bit, and then that causes the next area to allow charges to enter the cell. Right, that allows the next area for charges to enter the cell. So you see that as an electrical impulse is propagated along a nerve axon, these charges change places. Right, and so this is what we call a nerve impulse. It's when these charges are changing places across the cell membrane. And then to get back to the resting stage, we have positive charges on the inside, and they want to go back out to the outside to cancel the negative charge that's on the outside, right? And so a nerve impulse has got two phases associated with it. The first phase is when a positive charge enters the cell, and we call that depolarization. So this, I just want you to memorize and not have a really good feel for what's going on. You got to take a physiology class to get a really good understanding of what's happening here. But this electrical event on a cell, which we call an action potential, has got these two phases. The first phase is what we call depolarization, and that's when positive charges enter the cell. And then the second phase is what we call repolarization, and that's when positive charges leave the cell. So what do I specifically want you to know? Okay. An action potential is an electrical event on a neuron. The two phases are depolarization and repolarization. And what is depolarization due to? It's due to the entry of sodium ions into the cell. And we don't talk a lot about chemistry in here, so I'm using a term that you probably are not familiar with, and that is an ion. All right, an ion is a molecule that has a charge on it. So you see sodium right here. Na stands for sodium. It has a positive charge, so it's an ion. And when it moves, it produces an electrical current because it has that charge on it. All right, and so depolarization is due to sodium ions, in particularly entering the cell. And then what's the second phase of an action potential? Repolarization, right? Repolarization is the result of another ion, positive ion, but it's not sodium, it is potassium. And the chemical signal for potassium is K. That's probably not so important for you to know, right? But potassium is going to leave the cell, and that's going to bring the cell back up to its normal charge, its resting charge. So here's a question. Let's see if you can answer this question. What membrane component allows sodium and potassium ions to transit or move across the cell membrane? Okay. There's got to be what we call channels. There has to be protein channels inside the membrane. All right, so, what is a channel? Here's a channel right here. It's a protein that goes across the membrane. And these channels can be open or they can be closed. And in this particular case, it looks like this channel is closed. But if we let this video play out a little bit, guess what happens to it? When it binds neurotransmitter, look what happens to that gate right there. It opens up, and now ions can enter. So if sodium, like we just see right here, these are sodium ions entering the cell. Guess what's happening? What do we call this when sodium ions enter this cell? That's depolarization. And what you don't see on this video is potassium leaving. That would be repolarization. Okay. All right, so make sure you sign the sign-in sheet. And who's got the sign-in sheet? Wave that sign-in sheet around. Be right with you.